This matter of Zen. It's dealing with, as we've often said, with an inertial, ancient mind. A mind that basically is constantly creating a lie. And that lie goes largely unrecognized by most people because it's efficacious in operating in the world. By that I mean the breaking up of the world into convenient parts and linking them together in certain ways that allow you to do your karmic work. And making generalizations based on usually very little data. And these two allow one to do one's work, operating at their best. However, they can get one into a lot of trouble, precisely because they are inaccurate, they are a lie. But people have various defenses against that. They will blame other people if there is a misunderstanding. They will delete certain things that occur as being unimportant. They will do all kinds of things in order to preserve what? To preserve the construction that they have made in their own minds, which they mistake for reality the way it is. And of course, it is reality the way it is. Precisely because they don't question it, and they utilize it, and they may complain about it, but it's their reality. So I often tell people, never argue with people's reality, because it's always right. That is, for them. But this matter of Zen deals with that mind and that way we have constructed a world, and attempts to move this mass, this juggernaut, which otherwise crushes people, squeezes their life out of them, if they only knew it. As you all know, people complain about it, they do all kinds of things about this generalization which they call their life or the world and so on. They're disempowered, they feel they can do nothing about it because it's such a juggernaut, it's so massive. Not only externally, in terms of influencing political structures in the world, but also within oneself. It feels enormous. People try to use force the way they do in the external world. Trying to force themselves to think differently or do things differently or deviate from a path that they found is unsatisfactory and so on, and it never works. Or it has one hell of a price to pay if it does temporarily work. And so on and so on. You all know these things. In Zen, we encounter this fact of human being, the creation of worlds, the being buffeted by our own creation, imagining a self that is going to oppose these, or a self that has been constrained by them. And that's the story of human philosophy, and the wars in the world, the exploitation of the planet, other people, and so on. We talked about that yesterday. In Zen, we turn this right around. We go to the source. We say, let's not bother trying to solve these problems, we're trying to find a reality by ways that have been demonstrated throughout centuries to be useless. All they do at best is create another kind of a world that is a little bit more pleasant, but mostly they create worlds that it takes a lot of time to create. And so it occupies a lot of time and entertains themselves while they're doing it, and so on and so on. Political revolutions, moving to new places, whatever it may be that we do that's of that nature. In Zen it's different. Zen, we are the inheritors, fortunately, of those who have themselves with devotion looked at this matter and tried to find out what really is it all about? What really is the human condition? What really is what's commonly been called suffering, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha? What is it? And what is its source? And the Buddha did this. The Buddha said, I want to know the truth. I don't want to hang out anymore being a prince that is promised to have all kinds of wonderful things and has been protected from the many aspects of the world. I want to encounter it and I want to find out. I want to go to the bottom line, and he is our exemplar. Which he did. After he came to his awakening, his having gone to the source and the root, he could have adopted the tradition of the time in India, which in some ways it still is, that they feel that once you have done that, you have ended your life. There's no more significance to your life. You have accomplished the supreme thing that life was all about. And so you get to be treated as some kind of invalid, and people hang upon your words and so on. Zen says no. That too is very limited. We want the truth that enables us to live fully in every aspect of our life in the world. And to live without this source of unsatisfactoriness. And as Zen practitioners have done this over many centuries, they have found that so many things, in fact, everything has had reality attributed to it, but it has no existence. That is to say, separate existence, one of the teachings of the Buddha. There is no separate self. And this applies to everything, to the stone, to the tree, to human beings, to the birds, animals, whatever it is. There is no separate self. Everything is transformed, it is in flux. And people hear that and think it's a very interesting idea, and then they think about it. And they create more words and more philosophies and so on about it. And people studying Buddhism want to study that, so they read the sutras and all that. Another entertainment. Zen, the radical thing that it is, has traditionally, for the first 3 years, in the training of a person who really wants to go to the bottom line, says there is no reading. None. Zero. And it says all kinds of radical things. Burn the sutras. If you have a statue of the Buddha and you're cold, burn it in the fire to keep yourself warm. The master, when he came to awakening, and another master wanted to confirm that for him, he said, bring the seals and the documents. And the person for whom they were being brought said, and also attendant, bring fire. He was going to burn them as soon as they came. This is the radicalness of Zen. Why? Why? Because of this great juggernaut inertia of this mind. It sneaks in there. And we utilize this wonderful but paltry capacity that we have to utilize words and logic and reason and all that in order to deal with that which cannot be dealt with by that means. Because we are thinking real revolution here. It is all a mistake that the world has been broken up and into individual parts and that reality has been attributed to these as though that's all there is. Then it says fundamentally, the world is one thing. There is one reality. Fundamentally, the necessity is to realize that. That is to say, make it real in your own being so that thereafter you can live from it. And you can return to the words of digitalization, you can return to the realm of digitalization using words and using those things that previously broke up the world. You can use them as tools, as means, but you're not fooled anymore that they actually are anything more than attributed reality. And you get very comfortable encountering and living in the great mystery. And you get very comfortable living with not knowing. While at the same time, you use your intelligence and all your learning, and you operate with that in the world. But now you know that it's only arbitrary, attributed, useful. At best. And when you're sitting on the cushion, in comes this mind. And some folks try to fight it. Moo! Oh! Moo! Raise the sword of Manjushri. Not bad sometimes. Sometimes it's necessary. There's nothing that's wrong. It is only, is it the appropriate thing adaptable to the circumstance at the moment? And if one is tormented by these things, then that's not a bad idea to raise that sword. The way you would if weeds just kept growing up in your garden and you go out there, there's not going to be a single weed in this garden from now on. And you go out there with some aggression and remove all the weeds and keep an eye on them and pull them out whenever they raise their little green heads. Sometimes that's not a bad idea. Because sometimes it does create a space where things can happen. But it's temporary. It's not a final solution. And it's not something that really is fundamental about this practice of Zen. This practice of Zen is getting hip on this mind. And not being fooled by it, not thinking it's much bigger than you and it's a little, it will overwhelm you. Nor giving into it and utilizing it to try to solve something you can't solve. There's a koan in the Book of Equanimity that goes something like this. Zen Master Seppo told his assembled monks, there's a poisonous snake on the South Mountain. You better all look out. One of the monks, by the name of Choke, responded and he said, already many people in this room have lost their lives. This response was communicated somehow to another master by the name of Gensha, and he said, well, only Brother Choke could have said that. That's a unique response. But I'm different. The monk who told him about what Choke said, well, how is it for you? And he said, why bother just about South Mountain? In other words, this poisonous snake is not just in South Mountain. Umon, as soon as he heard about this snake, immediately threw his staff on the ground and jumped back with fear. Oh, what? Now this is a very interesting koan. Some of you have been working on it. But I'm going to present a different approach to it. How do we lose our lives? Many people in this room have lost their lives, said the monk. Why? They've been bitten by this snake. They've been... Snakes, by the way, are often very beautiful, are they not? Poisonous snakes especially. Beautiful colors, lovely. Enough to enable us to forget that they are the legendary snake in the grass. They don't make sound, they don't bark at us, they don't growl at us, they don't even have any claws. They're just little innocent creatures. I remember, and many of you have heard this story of mine, when I was in India, and I was up in the northern part of India, and I had hiked to a place called Lakshman Chakula, and I was trying to hike back on the other side of the Ganges to Rishikesh, where I was living at the time, to take the ferry across to Rishikesh. And the Ganges up there is just very beautiful. It's not the Ganges of Varanasi and Calcutta. It's the Ganges that's totally clean. Clear, you can see to the bottom of it, it flows quickly, it's just come down from the Himalayas. So I was walking through the jungle and along a narrow path, and I happened to catch up with a cow. You know, cows are everywhere in India. They're considered to be sacred because they are the animal of Shiva. So, it just happened for a little while to be walking beside this cow, and the cow, instead of continuing to amble along the way cows do, suddenly stopped. And I stopped too. I don't know why, it just reflexive. The cow stopped, I stopped. And out of the grass, out of the vegetation that surrounded this path, rose a cobra, sailing across the path with its head like the prow of a Viking ship. The back part of its body, it must have been, I don't know, I didn't say, could you wait for a minute while I measure how long you are? But it looked pretty long. 10 feet, maybe. And there it goes, back part of its body moving and the front part of its body just sailing across the path right in front of us. With its, whatever they call that thing around its neck, just inflated out. And beautiful, beautiful. Lovely appearance, beautiful, elegant, smooth-moving animal. And it went across the path, then it went down into the vegetation on the other side, down towards the Ganges, and maybe it just wanted a drink. So the cow moved on, and I stopped for a minute. I thought, God, it's not often you get to see a cobra. So I said, no, bad idea. Bad idea. And I kept walking. The snakes are often very attractive. People are attracted by snakes. They wonder about them. They love to stop in front of the containers in the zoos and look at these snakes. They're such unique beings. They're silent. There's really something about them. But they do get to bite you sometimes, these kind, and it means you lose your life. many people have lost their lives, and many people continually lose the life of this moment by allowing this snake to insinuate itself into your mind, seduce you away from maybe the beginning of a unitive relationship with Mu, and get you back into the digital world, analyzing and commenting and doing all kinds of things, figuring it out. What is Mu? Now, if Mu represents all things, that means I should be able to see Mu, but the oak tree looks very different from the grass. Now, what can it be that is the same among them all? Because it's supposed to be one reality, and on it goes. And you die! This happens all the time. You have to be street smart about it. And it's not just in the Zendo. So Genshō says, I'm different. How is it for you? Why bother with just South Mountain? This poisonous snake is ubiquitous in your life. Sometimes you might have a poisonous snake and you may be able to even pet it. You may be able to feed it a mouse now and then, satisfy it. But you never know. You never know when it's going to bite you and inject its venom into you and make it so you lose your life. Or at least you get very sick. What is the sickness of human beings? This is the sickness of human beings. Spending one's whole life involved with lies, instead of with the living life that is there for you. Is it not strange? Can we not look at that with the eye that sees people bothering themselves with things that have no existence, but only attributed reality? And by this attributed reality, people live and have torment. That is why in Zen we speak of it this like a dream. What happens in dreams? We have lost the capacity to recognize we're in a dream. And so we are scared by things, and we are moved by things, and attracted by things, and we have all kinds of adventures, but they are in a dream. Once we realize that, we say, glibly, oh, it was just a dream. But you don't realize that a dream is just an example of dreams. And that the same thing occurs, but with communal support, that it's not a dream, it is reality. And of course, since we create our own reality, we are gods, we have that creative function, that it is reality. It just doesn't exist, just as the realities in dreams, in sleep, do not exist. So once you really know that, then you can align with Mu in a different way. You see these little snakes that come in, and the beautiful snakes and the so on, threatening snakes, seductive snakes, whatever they are. You say, oh yeah, just one of those. And you're back to this unitive, embracing practice of Mu. And that frees you up. That no longer are these word-created realities so big and so much of a juggernaut and so scary that you can't play with them. So Ubon, being a well-developed individual, here's all this stuff about the snake, the poisonous snake. And he plays before them as a demonstration. You don't need to be afraid of this. You created it. Let me show you. Throws his staff down on the ground and jumps back with fear. But he made it up. Likewise, we don't realize that we make up these very snakes. We have bought into the lie. Instead of being taught, as we do in Zen, to confront it in a quite different way. Now you don't have to be frightened with it, you don't have to fight it, for it has no existence. But you do have to deal with it, because you have inherited, as we all have, we have inherited this human being, this human structure and function. That includes a particular thing that we call mind, which is very useful in our samsaric world, but is useless to give us access to this fundamental source life from which we can really live. And live to the point where all these other scary things in life are just seen for what they are. There's a koan in the Hekigen Roku, number 3, that it's also recurs in the Book of Equanimity, where Basso is very sick. And monks are really concerned about their teacher, the great Basso, who was a beacon among teachers of Zen. Sometime, probably in the late 700s, he was very ill, maybe near death. And the one of the head monks came to see him, delegated by the other monks. Please find out what's happening with our master. We haven't seen him for a couple of days now, and I hear he's very ill. Are we going to lose him? Head monk goes and says, Master, how are you? How are you feeling? How is it with you? And Basso, lying in his bed, says, with his quiet voice of experiencing the illness that he has, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced that his face had a peaceful joy about it. There's a book, why it was created, I know not. But in that book is a compendium of many imagined Buddhas. One of them is the sun-faced Buddha that lives for 1800 years. Another is the moon-faced Buddha that lives for but a day and a night. To Basso, the measure of a person's life is not its duration. The measure of a person's life is its quality, moment to moment to moment. At this moment, Basso was not scared. Basso saw through all these concerns. apostle, got well, survived, his illness cured, this is okay. If he didn't and died, that's okay. Now once one really gets on the wavelength of Zen, gets on the way of dealing with Mu or Hu or whatever your practice is, in the manner of letting go of the falsehood generating mind to try to resolve this question, any of the questions posed by Zen that are all meant to bring us to life. And instead, finds a way to disregard this poisonous snake mind. And instead, embrace this move. Rely upon it. Unify yourself with it. Find a way of disappearing into it. So even the Mu itself ultimately disappears. What this leads to is what we call awakening. And what you awaken to is what has always been there. And it often leads to some kind of startled response. Like you met someone who you really know, but you haven't seen for a while. Then you meet them. It's one of the Zen teachers of Tang said, it's like turning a corner on a street and meeting your father. He had no expectation at all that he was in town. Or it's like when you awaken like that, you realize, how was it that I spent all this time of my life thinking that reality was such? Why, look at it. Smell it. Taste it. Look at it. It's not that at all. And yet all those efforts, all those peregrinations, all those blind alleys, all those things were absolutely necessary to bring you to the place where you are now. I'm saying all of this in order that we realize that it is not words that are the enemy. It is not our habit of making maps and movies and constructing realities and generalizing and so on that's not the enemy. That's just a characteristic human capacity. It's our addiction to that as the only thing there is. We made a mistake, an innocent mistake. The whole culture supports that mistake. There's very few people, very few places in the world where that mistake is questioned. Zen, of course, is one of them. Zen is the supreme one because it doesn't substitute anything for the questioning of that and the revelation of its erroneous quality. It doesn't give you another story. And when you reach that place, you can then use words. And you can use your creative abilities, you can release your godlike quality. Just as Uman was able to play and create a snake out of a staff. One can live with a new vitality. And you constantly beat the world as yourself. That's not an instant thing. It needs time. It needs development. It needs refinement because of this inertia of this old mind that will sneak in and insinuate itself into your life and start packaging things and start entertaining you again and so on. And you have to recognize it. That's why when EQ, as you all know the story, was asked for a useful teaching about sin, he said, attention! And asked to elaborate, he said, attention, attention. Otherwise, in slips the poisonous snake. Under the guise of a beautiful thing, an entertaining thing, an enjoyable thing. But this snake can become so big that you get lost in its entrails. It's all imagination, but you don't realize it until you do. This is the story of our working with this mu and ourselves and to liberate the life that is really ours. So I want to just end today by reading you what has become a koan. Which illustrates about words. And one of Fakesu's monks said to him one day, wondering about these words and how to liberate oneself from this habit of breaking up the world. And he said, both speech and silence tend towards separation. What can we do? An honest question. Wonderful question. This monk must have experienced that silence in the sense of no words is in reference to words. It is not the silence of emptiness that is referred to in the Ara Sutra or the Diamond Sutra. It is in reference to that says, all right, I'll deal with this noisy mind by just being quiet, being silent. But it's still in the referential world. It still gives reality to words. It's just you're battling to keep the words out, but it's still in reference to the digitalized world. So the monk naturally must have been frustrated by this and wanted to know what to do. So he asked Fuketsu, his master. And Fuketsu gave a remarkable answer. He said, I often think of Conan in March. The partridge chirps among the scented flowers. Wow. How is that an answer to his monk? He used words, did he not? But therein is the difference. For Fuketsu, these were living words. They came from his whole being. They came from the innocence and emptiness of his mind that was able to respond to what he saw in this monk. The effect on the monk is not mentioned. So it's not that we have memories. It's not that we construct futures and plans. It's not that we talk about our experience. That's not it. But whence come those words? Are they alive? Are they coming from the experience of the moment? Are they coming from the vividness of that memory with Fuketsu? How do you respond to this day? How do you respond to the sound of that truck going up the hill right now that we hear? Is it a perturbation on the beautiful serenity of the fields around us and the forests? Or is it too an aspect of this reality of this moment that is to be treated equally to all, to the butterfly, to the beautiful flowers, to the smell of cut grass, to the leaves moving in the breeze, to the clouds building in the sky. Careful of this poisonous snake, the snake of division, the snake that produces the fear to live. Because in one's mind one has ideas of what is the proper thing to do, what is the right way, what might they think? And our life is sapped away. Our life is drained out of this moment. And this moment could not have been more full of life. Whether it's sitting in a zendo, feeling the pain of long sitting, whether it's outside hearing the insects, seeing the sun and the grass. This world, everywhere and at all times, is 100% full of this. What are we going to call it? Buddha nature does it violence. Fundamental nature. The one reality. They're all but words. Cultivating the real silence. The silence that no longer is run by the poisonous snake. The silence from which, when appropriate, words arise. Wonder of wonders. Where do they come from? We don't know. What is this reality? We don't know. We're not going to violate it by postulating something. We're just going to be here and trust. This is our last day of Sesshin this time. Please be mindful. Be mindful of the beautiful, familiar, poisonous snake. We'll end there today.